Support for Science Questions comes from USU's College of Science, advancing the educational experience of future scientists with advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn. There is a revolution quietly taking place in the field of biology that could spur a shift in the research paradigm. It is called epigenetics. It may underlie human disease and explain why humans are so different from mice, fish, and primates, even though we share the same number of genes. What makes us so different from other animals is a mystery scientists are trying to solve. Epigenetics could provide answers. It literally means above the genome. Simply put, it is something that affects a cell, organ, or individual without altering the genetic code. But it could influence how the DNA functions and whether a gene is turned on or off. It is providing compelling evidence that what we eat, drink, smoke, and experience in life sculpts heritable traits that can be passed on from one generation to the next through what's called our epigenome. Randy Jurdle is professor at Duke University in the fields of radiation oncology and pathology. Jurdle has made significant contributions and some novel discoveries in the fields of epigenetics and cancer. His work provides answers to the nature versus nurture debate.
I think this argument is starting to disappear. To me, it really isn't a controversy. They're almost mirror images of each other and are all interact with each other. When you can change the physical appearance of an animal by what you feed the mother in its food, I mean, that's nurture, isn't it, I think?
Marks or tags on the epigenome tell your genes to speak loudly or whisper, or switch on or off like a light bulb. Environmental factors such as diet, stress, and nutrition can leave chemical marks, imprints on genes that are passed on to children and even grandchildren. Because they can influence what makes us different from one another, and some more susceptible to certain diseases than others, Jurdle believes new studies in epigenetics are revealing rodents are probably not the best models for studying human disease. Instead, a much bigger mammal is the key.
I'm not saying that other animals are not important. They're all important in this whole earth that we live in. But we do not want to get misinformation. And that means at least a goodly amount of the stuff that we do has to be done, I think, in humans.
It is important to back up and understand how Jurdle got to these kinds of studies. His undergraduate degree is in nuclear engineering, and his radiation biology work turned him onto the epigenetics path. Here is my interview with Randy Jurdle about the turning point in his career and the burgeoning scientific field.
At the beginning of the 90s, I would say, we identified a gene, which is an insulin-like growth factor 2 receptor, as being a tumor suppressor gene in human cancer. And right at that very same time, Denise Barlow, who was at that time in Vienna, identified the IGF-2 receptor as being genomically imprinted. And that's a very, very strange way of regulating gene transcription, where though you inherit one copy of a gene from mom and one from dad, only one of those genes works for imprinted genes. And it's always the copy that's either comes from the father or from the mother, depending upon the gene that you're talking about. And that silencing is done epigenetically. And for IGF-2R, only in mice now, only the mother's copy works. So these genes are in effect susceptibility genes for a number of diseases, including cancer. And when I learned about that phenomena, which I had no idea what it was, I mean, I had none, because I don't have a background in genetics, let alone epigenetics. And this was in the beginning of the 90s, which not many people did either. I told the laboratory that we would be moving our whole research program into the field of epigenetics, and we did that over the next 4 to 5 years.
Epigenetics went from a phenomenon to a field, and it is getting a lot of attention these days.
The history of the field, it goes back quite a long time. I mean, probably 40, 50 years with Waddington, and developmental biologists, basically, that the question was, how can a single genome give rise to all these various tissues during development? So I think of the field of epigenetics and genomics like a computer. So if you think of the genomics, the DNA, being similar to the hardware of the computer, then epigenetics or epigenomics are the programs that tell that computer when, where, and how to work. So within our cell, we actually have a programmable computer. And that's why you can have a single set of genes, single genome, one from mom, one from dad, and you can have 250 to 300 different cell types because the programs are different for every one of those cells. That's the positive. The negative is because you're now using little chemical groups to, in effect, set up these programs very early in development, they're vulnerable and very vulnerable, actually, to environmental insults and exposures, much more so, I think, than the genome where you can mutate. But these are the epigenome, I think, is a lot more vulnerable to being deregulated by environmental insults.
How come we haven't heard that much about it until recently with your research?
Well, I'm doing the best I can, and a lot of other people are, too. I travel a lot. I was telling the people that invited me here that I think last year I counted it up because somebody said, well, how many times have you been invited to give talks this year? And I said, I think I'm up to DD or EE, which means it's like 30 or so talks in 1 year, and that's about all I can do. And I know other people are doing the same thing, so it just takes time for these this bit of information and its importance to get out. I don't think it's much different than if you looked at the time frame for tumor suppressor genes, for example, and oncogenes, and now they're just normal, common words in most people's vocabulary. My point is that I think that with time, we will also see that the word epigenetics will get into the common person's vocabulary, but it'll take a bit of time, maybe 5 to 10 more years, and it'll be there.
Epigenetics used to be a dirty word in science circles. Now, even though it can involve controversial work, it is the sexy new topic.
The field of epigenetics back in the old days, I am not a pioneer in the field of epigenetics. I'm sort of a somewhat pioneer. There were people working in the field of epigenetics back even in the decade before the 90s and even before that. But at that time, the molecular mechanisms for what we're talking about weren't known. So often what would happen is if people saw in science something they didn't quite understand, they said, well, it must be epigenetic. So I hate to say it almost became like a four-letter word. When you didn't understand anything, it was that. So it got a little bit of discredited, I would say, back then. And as I said, also we didn't know the molecular mechanisms by which epigenetics was functioning in our cell. And there were people back at that time who were told, particularly people that were involved in cancer research, where the field of epigenetics is most mature, that if you stay in the field of epigenetics, you will not have a career because everybody knows that cancer is a genetic disease. It is a genetic disease, but it's also a huge epigenetic disease. But at that time, people didn't appreciate it, and people did lose their careers. There are some people that persisted and persevered, but they were the true pioneers. I got into it at a time where you didn't get quite as much abuse when you were working in the field, and particularly because we worked in the field of genomic imprinting. And there's a very rarefied way, a group of genes that is regulated in a very unusual way. And so it didn't get out into the general population, but the people that were working in that field appreciated it.
So now is it becoming more standard then to look at, to consider epigenetics with studying cancer?
To answer that question, one way to do that is to look up the number of papers that are published in PubMed, which is where all the science literature is you can find it all, and is annotated. And in there, if you start in 1990, which is about the time that we got into the field of epigenetics, in any 1 year, you're talking maybe 5 to 10 papers total with the word epigenetics in the title somewhere within the paper. And so then if you look at that, you can get an idea of how many papers are being published total. So as of 2008, we had now 57,000 papers published with their word epigenetics in it. But last year, in 1 year alone, we added another 20,000 papers. So the field of epigenetics now, as far as publications in the scientific literature, is doubling every 1.5 to 2 years. That's growth. It's exponential.
A lot. Good for you and your lab.
Well, also for the group, and I think also, frankly, for humankind, because we're now, in effect, decoding line by line the programs of life. And with that, we're going to find a lot of problems that are causing many of these chronic disorders that we really have no clue what's causing them.
Nutritionist Rob Waterland, a former postdoc in Jerdl's lab, wanted to study the effects of nutrition on the epigenetic regulation of imprinted genes, which are genes whose expression is determined by the parent. Some genes are silenced by the mother and some by the father. They decided to use the agouti mouse, which is named after its agouti gene.
So we decided that that would probably be the best model to use from the standpoint of nutrition and what effects it has on the epigenome. And because it was connected with changes in the animal, its coat color, its size basically, whether they're obese or not obese, and susceptibility to diabetes and cancer. So all of that was clearly connected with in effect, the diet. But what we did and what Rob did in the laboratory is not only can you shift the distribution of these animals from, for example, being, let's say, primarily yellow and obese, the offspring, when the offspring's mother ate normal chow, you shift it to animals and offspring that are primarily brown, which now are lean, they're not obese, they don't get diabetes, and they don't get cancer. That was interesting, but what was most important about the study is that it was directly correlated with methylations in a particular region of the DNA upstream of the gene. So the very first time we connected early exposures, in this case, to nutritional supplements of the mother, to disease susceptibility in the offspring, years later, or at least days later, by a mechanism that didn't involve any changes in the bases in the genome, but was completely dependent upon alterations of the epigenome. So that was now, we knew, at least in that mouse model system, the memory system, how something that happened hundreds of days earlier could now give rise to diseases.
So in these yellow mice offspring, these yellow obese offspring, would their offspring have that same genetic marker? Or is that inheritable?
There's evidence in this specific model system that if you use yellow animals as mothers, you will tend to every generation have more and more yellow offspring, which appears that the epigenetic marks are not completely erased when they go through the egg formation. And there's a legacy. I think of it sort of like when I was a kid, you would have, for example, you would write on these little wax boards with the plastic over, you write your name or whatever on it, and then when you're done, you would flip it up and all the words were gone. Well, when the information is passed through the mom, that plastic is not completely flipped up, it appears, and there's still words left from the previous generation. So now you don't have to write the complete story, only a half of the story. And what happens is you get a gradual shifting over towards yellow offspring. If you do it the other way with brown, you will tend to get more brown offspring coming out, only when it goes through the mother. If this characteristic is passed to the dad at this location, it's always completely reset. So the ability to inherit things, what's called transgenerationally, these epigenetic changes, appears to be dependent also upon the sex at which it comes through. And not all genes and epigenetic marks are going to be passed through this way. It's very complicated and dependent upon the context, I think, of where these marks are found. All you're doing with any kind of environmental exposure is making more animals brown or more animals yellow. So when we were talking before where we supplemented the mother's diet with, for example, folic acid, choline, vitamin B12, and betaine. So why did we pick those? Because those compounds have those little tags that are called methyl groups that are ultimately put down onto the DNA, and all of those marks come in from our diet. That's why diet is so darn important in this whole process of programming. And remember that this marking occurs literally before the fertilized egg is implanted into the womb. So if you think about it from a human standpoint, if the same thing is happening there, it would be way before the mother even knows she's pregnant. The game at this stage is done. So it means a healthy diet is something you have to be thinking about all the time, not just when you're thinking, quote, about being pregnant or after you're being pregnant, but all the time. Now, I know we don't all have the greatest diets, but it's important to start thinking along those lines. Now, with bisphenol A, when we put that into the diet, what happened there is what we shifted in before, we shifted towards more brown offspring. Now we have many more yellow offspring. So something with this endocrine disrupting agent altered the ability to methylate, put those little marks at the DNA, and as a consequence, you have many, many higher percentage and many, many more animals that were yellow, became obese, diabetic, and ultimately developed cancer. So in this model system, why do all those things happen? This little agouti gene, the product of it, the little protein that's made, normally should only be made in hair follicles. So why we see an animal, a mouse, as being agouti or brown is because normally the hair shaft is black, and right at the end of the development of the hair shaft, the agouti gene is turned on, and you have a little band of yellow that's put right at the base of the black hair shaft, and we now see that as brown. So in the animals, for example, they're yellow, there's another the gene is being regulated differently, and it's inappropriately turned on throughout the whole body rather than just in the hair follicle at all stages of the mouse's development, including what's called the satiation center of the brain. This is the center of the brain that tells the mouse that he's full and he should stop eating. So this little bit of protein, this little agouti protein, binds to a receptor, inactivates it, and in that, as a consequence, that animal now never knows it's full, and it eats itself into obesity, diabetes, and cancer. It's amazing, a coat color gene you would have never ever thought to be involved in obesity, diabetes, and cancer, but in this model system, because of the way it's expressed inappropriately in the animal, it now is.
Have you been able to reverse it all?
Everybody asks this, and when I first was asked, I sort of blew it off. It's like, you know, this is another thing that would be nice to do, but I probably will never do it. I more than likely will never do this experiment, but a colleague of mine actually, it hasn't been published, but apparently has done it, and this is a person in Japan, and we sent these animals to him, and he said, have you ever looked at these animals, these offspring, if you keep them on this high methylating diet? I said, no, we don't, you know, our experiments are pretty short in time. He said, well, we did this. He said, we've taken pictures of them, and there's no doubt that with time, these yellow animals become brown. So you're reversing this effect, apparently, by continual long-term exposure, even after birth, that you can now reverse a yellow animal into a brown animal by supplementing their diet continuously throughout life. But this has not been reported, and I don't know of anybody that's actually reported this scientifically yet.
You are listening to an interview with Randy Jurdel, professor of radiation oncology at Duke University. His epigenetics research is gaining widespread attention. Back in a moment. I'm Sherry Quinn. Listening to Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn. scientist Randy Jurdle is joining us to talk about the emerging field of epigenetics.
The beauty of the era that we're coming into now, and particularly I think with the epigenome roadmap now being funded, is that there's more resources not only coming into scientific laboratories but also going into companies that are developing sequencers. So the tools that we're going to have to work with in the next 5 to 10 years for sure are going to be amazingly better than what we have even right now, and they're pretty incredible right now. So the ability to do the kinds of things that you're asking about, in effect mapping out the whole set of marks and programs that are present on the genome, is going to be possible. And once that's possible, when somebody has a disease or a disorder, you do the same thing and you compare them, and you're going to see the changes that are there, and some of those changes are going to give rise to these problems. But we can't do that so easily now because we do not quite have the tools and the computer power and storage capacity, really, to do this. But this will change fast.
This will be a huge amount of data, right?
Huge. People that work in this field know how much data. One of the big problems now is not just getting the data. It's like, where do you put it? How do you store it? How can you put it into a system that you can access it and look at it? It's a big problem. It's called bioinformatics. It's a huge bioinformatics problem. In a way, at this level, biology is becoming sort of like physics, computer science, and statistics. Fields that never ever really were involved much with biology in the past are now becoming some of the primary players in this field of biology.
Is there any indication that the epigenome is more malleable or more susceptible to changes than our genome?
The genome is very static. It's like the physical computer. I mean, you can go in there and take a hard drive out. You can remove a chip. You can do these kinds of things, but it's basically pretty solid. And those types of things I'm saying would be comparable to mutations in the genome. But the epigenome is much more malleable. It can be changed more easily by the environment. And that's the same thing, for example, with software in a program. It's very easy to go in and change a line of code, or frankly, unfortunately, it's quite easy for viruses to come in and screw up your programs also. They're vulnerable. This is an adaptive mechanism, though, because it allows now the animal, and even while it's developing, to perceive what the environment is going to be when it's born. So in other words, if the mother is exposed to famine, very low nutrition, it's not advantageous to be large. It's advantageous to be small because from the standpoint of propagating your genes forward, you're not going to take as much energy if you're smaller rather than large. And also it's advantageous to be able to store energy very efficiently. And throughout the history of most animal species on Earth, they've usually not had abundance of food. They've had a shortage of food. So for generations, humans have been exposed to not having great amounts of food, so they become very efficient in storing energy. And as we know, there tends to be smaller stature. We know now with the Western diets, people's heights are going up, etc., along with that. So it's the opposite's happening. But that adaptive mechanism now that says we're going to be involved and going to be exposed to a sort of a shortage of food once you're born, in this modern era, particularly in Western culture, is not what the individuals find themselves exposed to. They find themselves exposed to large quantities of food, a large amount of calories, and not having to expend very much energy to get it. So there's the mismatch between what was perceived and what you find yourself in an adulthood, and that's why you have this increased incidence throughout the world, epidemic of obesity, diabetes, and cancer. One reason.
So can it influence evolution and epigenetics?
It possibly can. In plants, it's for sure there's it's pretty, I think, clearer there with variegations, temperature sensitivities, etc., that you can, these things can go on for generations, multiple generations. In animals, it's not so clear. Because even as I said, these epigenetic changes that we see in the agouti mice, there's not any real hardcore evidence that this happens with other species and including ourselves. I think it probably is there, but we don't have any real data right now at this time. But the one place where epigenetics, I think, might have played a huge role, particularly in mammals, from an evolutionary standpoint, is with genomic imprinting. Because once that system arose for the mother and father to silence genes differently, and that occurred about 200 million years ago, that gave rise to marsupials, which are like the opossum, and us and mice, the eutherian mammals, the true placental mammals. All of those mammals have these imprinted genes. All animals below, as far as we know, do not. Now you have the potential of either taking the machinery and putting around a non-imprinted gene, and it can be imprinted, or you can take another gene and pop it into an imprinted domain, and it's captured. Most times this will be not advantageous, the having only one copy working, for example. But sometimes it's unbelievably advantageous. So the thought now is that once this system evolved, that genomic imprinting was used to speciate, and rapidly speciate, on an evolutionary scale, because this imprinting system was in place. And that then would give rise to variations in imprinted gene repertoires, the number of genes and type, the genes that are imprinted in humans, let's say, versus mice. And the farther you are apart from each other evolutionarily, the greater the differences are going to be. Now, why do I go into this in such detail? Because indeed, that's what we see. And as a consequence, then, to the degree that these imprinted genes are involved in neurological disorders, like cancer, etc., we have a different set of those than a mouse. So there's different mechanisms that can come in play to get neurological disorders like autism and schizophrenia in humans. And mice might not be the best models for cancer, for example, for things that occur through the dysregulation of imprinting, because those genes might not be imprinted there, whereas they are here, or vice versa. It's something that's very hard for scientists to understand, or at least to accept, but it is not hard for the general public to understand, and that is this: mice are not humans. And this is particularly true when you're talking about diseases and disorders that are resulting from alterations in the epigenome, particularly imprinted gene dysregulation, rather than mutations in the genome. And I don't think as scientists have really come to grips with this yet. It could be one of the reasons why we have been more successful in curing, for example, mouse cancer than we have at least perceived ability to cure human cancer. If the model is not always quite right, we might be barking up the wrong tree. The other place where this is extremely important is, what do we use as surrogates for us from the standpoint of risk assessment from exposure to compounds? We use rodents usually. Again, the same problems. It might be that it's going to be harder to extrapolate those results. So what does this mean? It means that we're going to have to start doing more epigenetic studies with the species that we're truly interested in, which is ourselves. But it means that science will have to be done differently than it's ever been done in the past. You will have to get teams together to get the samples from humans, which is much more difficult than designing an experiment in your laboratory office for the use of mice. But just because it's hard doesn't mean that it doesn't need to be done, or the other way around, is just because it's easier to do things and more elegant to do things in mice, if you're trying to extrapolate it to humans and it's not extrapolatable, why are we doing it?
That was Randy Jurtle, professor of radiation oncology at Duke University. Thanks for listening.
So the most important, not from the standpoint of deregulating, most susceptible time is really literally right after fertilization and during fetal development right after birth, where there's a lot of growth.
Special thanks to Renee Dawson for bringing Randy Jurtle to our attention. And thanks to the Department of Pathology in the School of Medicine at the University of Utah for making this interview possible.